Welcome to the Big Three podcast. This podcast answers three big questions raised from Sunday's sermon by the congregation of Guymere Baptist. The Big Three Pod seeks to discuss these questions, explore issues, unpack theology, provide further information and explanation to help your faith grow. You can listen to the original sermon on your favourite podcast platform or at guymerebaptist.org.au. Our prayer is that this pod helps you as you follow Jesus.
Well, welcome to the Big Three. My name is Mark. I'm the senior pastor here at Guymere Baptist Church and your host for the next half hour or so as we do look at a few questions that were raised from Sunday's sermon. On Sunday, we jumped back into Romans, a series that we've been going through over the course of the year, kind of term by term and section by section. And unlike the first two terms where we looked at the end of Romans, chapters 12 through 16 in term 1 and chapters 9 through 11 in term 2, we have finally gone back to the beginning. And the reason, as I keep repeating, because it is an odd way to go through Romans, is an idea that stems from a scholar named Scott McKnight. And he reckons that if we are to best understand the doctrinal and theological opening chapters 1 through 8, we are really well served to focus on the pastoral issue that Paul seems to be addressing in chapters 9 through 16. And more clearly we can keep that focus in mind, the clearer we'll be able to navigate Paul's theology. Unlike popular readings of Romans, which tends to treat Romans 1 to 8 as kind of an overview of the gospel, a universal description, this kind of focuses us on considering how the Roman congregation, a congregation that, amongst other things, seems to have been struggling with some relational fracture lines between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians, it helps us keep that in mind and how they would have heard Paul's opening chapters, right? And the way they would have applied them. So anyway, we're in chapters 1, finally, halfway through the year. And for the next 5 or 6 weeks or so, we're going to be looking at chapters 1 through 4 of Romans before having a break, and then finishing the year in chapters 5 through 8. The questions this week, there's a couple questions about essentially around translation issues, which is going to make for an interesting discussion, I hope, and one focused quite squarely on the issue at hand. So here are the questions. Why does Paul choose to delineate that the Jews are the first to be saved? Second question. Verse 16 in other Bibles says gospel of Christ, and the Greek says euangelion to Christu. It was said Christ wasn't mentioned. Can you please explain? I can. And the third question, Romans 1:13 in the NIV says harvest, which is translated from the Greek karpos, which is fruit. Does use of the actual meaning change how we should interpret this? So it's a different set of questions, which is fantastic. So looking forward to getting stuck into it. So let us do so. So the first question, I think, really focuses in on what's going on in the letter to the Romans as a whole. Why does Paul choose to delineate that the Jews are the first to be saved? And this comes right out of chapter 1, verse 16. Where Paul describes the gospel that he wants to preach to the Romans when he finally gets there. Right? That's the whole kind of point of verses 8 through 15, right? I've really wanted to be there, haven't been able to. I'm pretty sure I'm going to get there this time, and I really want to, so we can mutually encourage one another's faith, and I want to preach the gospel and all that sort of stuff. And then he defines the gospel as the power of God to save those who are believing or who have faith, right? First to the Jew, then to the Gentile. And verse 16 and 17, as I said on Sunday, is one of the areas of a scholarly agreement that verses 16 and 17 of Romans chapter 1 forms the main proposition, the thesis statement that Paul is going to be unpacking throughout the rest of the letter. And so given that that is such an important two verses, right, kind of says, okay, this is what you're going to be hearing, this is what you're going to be reading, the question, which has been asked, why does Paul choose to focus on the Jews first and the Gentiles, is a really important question. Now, I suppose on the surface, the reason why Paul focuses on the Jews first and then the Gentiles is because he really wants to somehow hold together the Jewish distinctiveness. He wants to hold together the Jewish privilege, shall we say, in election and history, while at the same time making space for the Gentiles. And so he's going to be focusing on that, particularly at the end of the letter, as we've seen. So I think Paul drops it in here because of his pastoral concern. And this is, again, why I think Scott McKnight's idea of preaching Romans or reading Romans backwards is such a valuable one. Because if you think about other places in the epistles, the ones that Paul wrote, that is, 1 and 2 Corinthians or Galatians or Ephesians or Colossians, when Paul talks about the gospel, he tends to talk about, you know, Christ crucified, as he does in Corinthians. But he also does utilize the gospel to address the issues that he is seeking to rectify in these fledgling communities. And so there's a reminder that the gospel, while it may be simple, is not simplistic, right? Anytime you're talking about God saving humanity and restoring and renewing all things, you can summarize it in a sentence, right? Christ crucified, Jesus saves us from our sins, or whatever you want to frame it up. But really, it is such a complex, massive thing that it is multifaceted. And Paul just picks up certain facets of the message of the gospel and draws attention to them. And there's great value in that, right? There's great value in taking various aspects of big story and applying them to situations. So, like, politicians do it all the time, right? They take an element of the Australian story that they want to highlight and emphasize, right? So, you know, is it John Howard and the Battlers, the Aussie Battlers? It picks up a particular part of our heritage and draws attention to it. It's not the only feature of Australian culture, but it served a purpose in terms of some of the policy decisions being made. Paul, to some degree, is doing the same, although he's not writing as a politician, but he wants to bring about change in the community in Rome. He wants them to act, shall we say, more in line with the gospel. And so he draws attention to one feature of the gospel, and that is that the gospel unites people by faith in the salvation that Jesus offers. And because he was addressing a group that was fractured by differences of opinion over deeply important and long-held traditions that were not just social traditions, but were deeply spiritual, you know, around the law and its observance, he really needed a long run-up to it. So I think that's the simplest reason. Paul is showing his hand in verse 16 about what he is going to be on about. He wants to talk about the gospel. Yes, he does. But he wants to talk about a particular component of the gospel that is particularly important for the Roman church to apply, to put into practice, to hear again, and not just hear, but obey, right? To go beyond the, oh, yeah, in Jesus we're all one. That's fantastic. But say, oh, in Jesus we are all one. And so the emphasis on Sunday is I tried to draw attention to the places where Paul's final landing spot, right, the call to unity, shows up early. The mutual encouragement and the language of social cohesion and obligation towards one another, this language kind of permeates even the opening, because that's where Paul's going. And so that first to the Jew, right, is meant to really kind of highlight for us and for his original readers, or hearers, I should say, where Paul's going. And I think, you know, I guess at a secondary level, he says first to the Jew, then to the Gentile, because to some degree that is the chronological order in which salvation was granted. God did something amongst the Jewish people first, right? In calling Abraham and then leading them out of Egypt under Moses and providing them with the law. And it was that group of people who built the temple and had the kings and all the prophets and the promises of the Messiah, the one to come who would usher in the kingdom of God. And right, Jesus was a Jewish man who was prophesied by the Old Testament prophets, right, who steeped in the Old Testament, well, what we would call the Old Testament, but the Hebrew scriptures. So chronologically, we could also say that the Jews were the first to receive that salvation, and then to the Gentiles. That's also grounded, of course, in that situation. So for us today, we would still want to reach out to Jews who we might know, who are interested or keen to learn more about Jesus. We would want to kind of reach out to them, certainly. But in the context that Paul is writing to, it's his pastoral concern and the wider chronology, I think, that really focus or sit behind his decision to draw attention to that part of the gospel story in verse 16. So the second question is this. Verse 16 in other Bibles says gospel of Christ, and the Greek says euangelion to Christu, the Greek terms for good news and of Christ. It was said Christ wasn't mentioned. Can you please explain? So let me first of all say I'm very impressed that anyone would actually be able to put in the Greek text. That sounds like a lot of work to find another font and to get it all in there properly or to copy and paste it. But well done, you, whoever managed to do that. So in the description of the gospel, right, which we were talking about in the last question as well, in verses 16 and 17, Paul says in verse 15, I want to preach the gospel to you. And then verse 16, he says, this is the gospel. It's the power to save the first the Jew, then the Gentile, right? The righteousness of God is revealed and whatnot. And drew attention to the fact, which he's just spent a little bit of time talking about, that Paul talks about the Jew and Gentile piece because that's where he's going. But he also doesn't mention explicitly Jesus. And so the question is related to the text undergirding it. So I actually busted out my United Bible Society 4th edition Greek text to have a bit of a look myself. And what I found was that in the Greek text that underlies the NIV UK, which is the version that we tend to use here. It does not contain the of Christ part in the Greek. And the reason is that the Greek text that stands behind the NIV is a different one than some of the other translations that you might be referring to. Now, I had a very quick look at the leading candidate for the inclusion of the term of Christ. That was the King James Version because the King James Version used a different base text. And lo and behold, of Christ was found in the King James Version. I had a look at a few others, just a handful, and they all reflected the NIV text. So what's going on is this. First of all, the King James Version, for instance, used what was called the Textus Receptus. It was the received Greek text, but the commissioning for the King James Version was like 1611 or something like that. And so it's a 17th century text, quite old in many regards. And it was before some of the really significant work around textual criticism had happened. Textual criticism is essentially the work of comparing all the manuscripts that we have. We have some very old manuscripts in Greek. We have some relatively recent ones prior to the 17th and 18th centuries. And scholars began the work of collecting and seriously comparing them. They couldn't really do that until after the printing press, which was obviously much earlier than 1611. But the printing press enabled people to make identical copies. Because one of the reasons why we have to compare the earlier copies is that they were all handwritten. And when you handwrite something, you inevitably make mistakes. You might skip a line, you might skip a word, You might miss a piece of punctuation. You might misspell a word. You might come across something ambiguous and seek to correct it or to clarify it in its context, whatever the case might be. And some of those corrections might get picked up by others, and on it goes. And so the work of textual criticism, which began in earnest in the 1700s in particular, late 1700s, was the work of comparing and trying to create the nearest representation to what we believe the original was. Now, that work uncovered all sorts of variants. There are no variants that are of theological significance. So it's not as if we have one text that says Jesus rose from the dead and another text that says no, he didn't. The differences are, as I mentioned, quite minor. The skipping of a line or the misspelling of a word or the not including a piece of punctuation or whatever the case might be. They tend to be fairly simple. But because they were copies of copies of copies, that error would then get promulgated throughout all the rest. And so there was this long, long process of working out which texts were original. The text that we now base most of our modern translations on is no longer the Textus Receptus. I think it's used as one of the sources in the wider text that we use. But the text that we now use, the United Bible Society, I think it's the fourth edition, is kind of the standard text. And so it has dropped out the reading of Romans 1:16 that included the good news of Christ. It's dropped out the of Christ. And the reason, in the United Bible Society Greek version, where there are major variants, significant variants, they will often include a footnote in the apparatus, as it's called, the textual apparatus, that will tell you which manuscripts contain the variant. Because there are certain manuscripts, and this is, I'm sorry if this is confusing, I hope it's not. There are certain manuscripts in the tradition, right, that are particularly significant. In particular, those that are quite old, right? The older the manuscript, the more weight it has. The more complete the manuscript is, the more weight it has. And so if there are really significant manuscripts that contain a variant, they will often have a footnote basically saying, look, in this verse, this is the reading that we have chosen, and here's the reasons why. There's actually an appendix book that you can read that explains some of their decisions. But in the apparatus, it will include the other manuscripts. That was not actually the case in Romans 1:16, which tells me that the inclusion of the little clarifier of Christ was quite obviously added to clarify or to add clarity to what was a little bit ambiguous, or to clarify what, well, we all kind of know to be true, right? The good news that Paul's talking about does include Jesus, and he does, of course, get to that. But the original, the most likely original reading does not include the of Christ. So, for whoever this may be, if you are referring to a Greek text and can try to determine the source of it, I think what you're after is the United Bible Society fourth edition is probably pretty useful. And you also want the Nestle Aland or the 20, what is it? The 26th edition of the Novum Testamentum Grace, the Nestle Aland. And that's the one that you'll find behind the NIV. So how's that for a little bit of a tricky conversation? But that's why the wording was a little bit different, and why I felt confident to say that the of Christ was not explicitly in there. I think it had been added at some point in time in a minor manuscript that had been picked up by the Textus Receptus and therefore translated into the English versions that used that as their base text. There's more to say about translation, but that's probably more than enough for a Wednesday morning or whenever you might be listening to this. So we'll move on. The last question is also a little bit about translation, but not quite so much about the actual Greek text that lies behind it. But Romans 1:13 in the NIV says harvest, which is translated from the Greek word karpos, which is fruit, does use of the actual meaning change how we should interpret this. So there's two kind of pieces within this that I think are important to note. First of all, the Greek term karpos does have a range of meanings, which are often determined by context. So fruit is one, that'll be its simpler definition. Harvest is another, depending on the context. So there's kind of a range of meanings, first of all, that we have to be aware of with the Greek terminology. You know, sometimes they're very clearly just one thing, but not often. Often the words have a couple of different ways that they can be understood, and we have to make some sense of them in context. The second piece within that is just a reminder that, you know, when we read the New International Version, the UK edition, we are reading a translation of the Hebrew and the Greek text. And so scholars are... and there's usually a committee of scholars who are engaged in that process, have to make decisions about the words that they choose, right? If there's a range of meanings, they have to determine from context which word might be best suited. There are other questions about, you know, do they go for a literal translation or do they try to do something a little bit more dynamic that utilizes the conventions of the language into which they are translating? So, for instance, in English, it is good form to use synonyms, right? So instead of using the same verb or the same noun over and over and over again, we consider it good form to use synonyms. So there are a number of places, though, where in the Greek, they use the same term over and over and over and over again. But because we are seeking to write a good English translation, they mix them up a little bit because that makes sense in the receptor language. Translation is an imperfect science. There is no translation that is perfect, because, well, that's not how translation works, right? You're always translating. And that's the reason, to some degree, why there are so many versions of the Bible out there, as scholars have tried in a variety of ways to try to make the ancient languages of Greek and Hebrew and a little bit of Aramaic readable and understandable for us in English. All of that's important. So the range of meanings, scholars have to make those decisions as they go. And then the question at kind of at the end, does the use of the actual meaning change how we should interpret this? And I would say that one of the values of having some understanding of Greek or Hebrew, and my understanding of Hebrew is negligible. My understanding of Greek is probably just enough to be dangerous, if I can put it that way. It's not like I'm nowhere near, even when I was taking Greek at Bible college, at the end of my year of Greek, I was not anywhere near ready to translate. That's a very, very complex task that requires a very, very high degree of proficiency and skill. But there's value in being able to get behind the English translation to identify, in particular, keywords, to identify variations, which suggest that there's an interesting word that has been rendered in different translations differently, and that can draw attention then to different, what I would call, hermeneutical options. And hermeneutics is the art and science of interpreting texts, or interpreting anything, really, whether it's a book or an artifact or a art piece or whatever. And so when we look at the Greek term and we see that, oh, okay, this the Greek term that sits behind the English term harvest also has the meaning of fruit, that does open up, I think, some options for us to think a little bit differently about the thing that Paul is seeking to do. I mean, you know, you do harvest fruit, right? So you don't harvest the blossoms or the buds or the, right? You wait until it's fruitful and then you harvest it. So you can see the connection between them. And you might ask questions then about, you know, was the use of the harvest feels a little bit more final than just fruit, but he wants to gain the fruit. And so, but it does open up observations and questions and comments and other areas to think about the text. And so broadly speaking, yeah, it does change, or it can change the way we interpret a text. In most instances, you will find that the agreement between translations is substantial. If you were to compare the English Standard Version, the ESV, and the NIV, and the Contemporary English Version, the CEV, and compare them, you would find that while they would read differently, the basics of all three of them would be very, very close. It's actually not a bad practice if you are wanting to study the Bible a little bit more deeply, but don't want to study and learn Greek or Hebrew, which is most of us, I think. It's a good practice to get into to read the passage that you are studying in a few different translations. Because when you read a text in a few different translations, you will notice where there is, I wouldn't say disagreement, but where there is nuance in the translation. Often there's not much there. It all sounds broadly the same, but every so often you kind of pick up the fact that, oh, this piece, this section, these words seem to have a broader range of meanings than just one, because these translations are all quite different in terms of the emphasis or the focus. In which case, then I think it's helpful to find a commentary that might deal with the Greek or the Hebrew and find out why the difference. What's going on with the range of meanings? As I said, most of the time it's negligibly different. But every so often, there's some value in picking that stuff up as we go along. So the instance here of, you know, fruit or harvest, I think, is a good example, because broadly speaking, that's the same idea. You know, harvest, I think, does pick up for us in terms of the rest of our English New Testament, the idea of, you know, conversion, which is not quite what Paul's getting at. The idea of fruit might more easily lead us to the idea that Paul's just looking for them to be fruitful as followers of Jesus, because we find the fruit of the Spirit and those sorts of things found in the letters. So that can be helpful. But ultimately, the translations that we have are in pretty large agreement about the issues within it. I was at Moreland College yesterday because Tuesdays is my day, and I was preaching, and we watched a sermon as part of an exercise in illustrations. And the preacher was preaching on Hebrews 12, where it talks about Jesus as the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, as it says in the New Testament, sorry, in the NIV. And he just pointed out that in the Greek, there is no our. And he reckons that it's much better to see it as Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith, the one who has gone further and done more to live faithfully than anyone, and therefore someone that we can follow. That's a place where I think reference to the Greek and the decisions that have been made, I think, do make a bit of a difference to how we understand that passage. Not that that's a new idea. I think the idea that Jesus is the pioneer and perfecter of faith is certainly a good, solid New Testament one. And we can make a case, of course, that he is the pioneer and perfecter of our faith as well. That's not a heresy, to put it that way. But it invites us then to consider both and think about the implications for what it looks like for us to follow Jesus. So there's value in that. So thank you for those questions. It was a very different kind of direction today. I had a lot of fun. I don't know how you found listening to it. Hopefully you've made it all the way to the end. If you have, thank you so much. Hope that you can join us again next week. And next week, we're going to be looking at Romans 1, 18 to 32, where Paul talks about what Jews and Gentiles need to be saved from. That is the sin that so easily and entangles, if I can pick up a Hebrews phrase. So it's going to be a, I'm anticipating that there'll be lots of questions. That's all I'm going to say. So I hope you can join us on site or online next week, and that you can join me again sometime next week for the Big Three. Until then, God bless.
Thanks for joining us at the GBC Big Three podcast. We trust you found this inspiring, encouraging, challenging, but ultimately helpful to enable you to follow Jesus. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can also listen to the We Are The Church podcast, a discussion pod with real stories from real people at Guymere Baptist as they share their experiences of faith and discipleship in action. If you've enjoyed this pod, why don't you rate and review it? This way others can discover the podcast too.